Hello, everybody. We're back again. It's Marlene Johnson with Sounds for Seniors. Sorry about that, but we finally got some music back on the air. And our apologies. It is now 3:23, and you're listening to Sounds for Seniors coming to you from CKLU, located at Laurentian University. Every once in a while, like we have the last few Fridays, it seems to be easier on a Friday to do it in the summer than it is in the winter when they're all iced and snowed in and cold in and frozen in and what have you. Under a segment called Some of Sudbury's Secrets, we have an interview, and we have another young man today. He has a very unique hobby, and I think it's more than a hobby. I think it's his passion and his magnificent obsession. To quote from earlier things, sounds pretty good, doesn't it? His name is Michel Deschamps, and Michel is the UFO guy, or the flying saucer guy. How are you, Michel?
Not too bad. Yourself?
Not too bad. I wanted to know how things were going. Any new news or any new items or occurrences that are happening? Because I remember a bit about all of this, and I think it would be interesting to share with our readers. Go ahead.
The only news I got from this year was a sighting that took place on May 11th, actually in town here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the only problem is I don't know exactly where it was seen, but it was apparently, I wouldn't call them really a prominent couple, but they do a lot of volunteering, and they just don't want their names associated with the sighting. Basically, the wife saw three lights dancing around each other in a beautiful blue sky and called out her husband, and the lights were actually also traveling in a straight line. And I asked them, says, if they would have had vapor trails, would they look like the DNA strand? And he says, exactly perfect description for it. But it was just three solid lights dancing around each other while traveling in a straight line.
Now, were they colored lights, or were they just like white lights, or were they...
No, just white lights.
Just white lights,
yeah.
Eh? Yeah, because a lot of time, I know years ago, when I was dabbling around in that kind of stuff, I remember that we had a lot of mistaken... Of course, that's almost 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of mistaken sightings with people with, you know, the red and green flashing lights on an airplane, plus maybe another light or something.
Venus.
Venus
is a famous one.
Maybe it depends how many drinks you had. Maybe you see a lot of flashing lights. So, how long have you been doing this, Michelle?
Since age 10, so it's over 25 years.
Over 25 years. Well, yeah. You're giving away your age. Well, I'm 68, so
yeah.
Who cares? And you've documented quite a few cases over the years, haven't you, Michelle?
Yeah, my expertise actually lies in coming here at Laurentian University and looking through the microfilms for the five Northern Ontario newspapers that they have.
Yes.
Kirkland Lake, North Bay, the Sioux, Timmins, and Sudbury.
Yeah.
And I've been able to find in the Sudbury Star alone from June 1947 to December of 89, over 350 clippings.
Well, you know, I'm going to share with you and with the listeners, there was one time when I was doing a bit of reporting on it, and I used to check with people that were scientifically inclined. I won't get into who they were or where. They would verify that it wasn't a satellite, or it wasn't Venus, or it wasn't this and wasn't that. And because these people were friends of mine, and I'm not scientifically inclined, so if I tell you, I myself have seen a flying saucer, more than likely it was the bottom of a teacup set or something. So anyway, getting back to this other, it was over the old radar base out at Falconbridge. And I remember taking the report and investigating the whole thing and everything. But when Sudbury Star called me at the time, I said, you better make sure that they don't know I'm a woman. And so when it was on the front page of the Sudbury Star at the time, the upper section of the first section of the Sudbury Star, but of course I wasn't in there, they said they had talked to a man. And of course that must have thrown a lot of people off. They wouldn't have known. No names were mentioned, of course, anyway. But it was after that when they found out that I had a friend that was working at the radar base that I couldn't get any more information. Because it was right in the newspaper, you see. So anyway, it was kind of interesting. What's your most interesting case to date that you can recall, Michelle?
I would say it'd be the landing at Manitoulin in Spring Bay.
Now, when did this happen? Tell us all about it.
This
please.
Took place in the mid-1990,
yeah.
Mid-September 1990.
Yes.
But I only got to go to the site actually in June of 91.
Yeah.
And basically what it was, There's this clearing that consists of limestone with a covering of about maybe 3/4 inch of gravel.
Yes.
And it's unseen from the road. You have to go in 1/4 mile into the bush.
Uh-huh.
And the gravel is actually blown away at two locations in two large donut-shaped indentations. Actually, the indentation was caused by the fact that the gravel was removed on top of the limestone, which was underneath.
Yes.
And so they were both irregular circles. I'd say each were about 6.5, 9 feet across.
Yes.
And about maybe 16 feet from center to center.
Oh, really?
So it was pretty close proximity to each other.
Yes.
And I do have the one clipping that the first reporting of it with a photo that came from the Manitoan Recorder.
Yeah. How did you hear about this? Like, did someone call you, or did you just read about it in the Gorbea Recorder? That's the newspaper from Gorbea, eh?
Yeah. It is. But no, it's the oddest thing. Actually, I was listening to Midday Q with Melanie Dahl.
Yeah.
And she was talking with an expert, or a so-called expert, on crop circles.
Yes.
And basically, she quickly mentioned that there had been a couple of circles found in the Sudbury area.
Yes.
So I talked to her, and she put me in touch with the guy while she took the pictures.
Yes.
But all I got to see once I met the guy was a strip of negative.
Yeah.
And I couldn't really readily see that it was on grass, but as soon as I got the pictures developed, I'm looking, and it's like, it's gravel and stone. There's no grass at all.
Yeah.
And it was not, as it became later known what crop circles were about, it wasn't even at all what crop circles are recognized as.
Yes.
So I said, well, this has got to be something else. This is something else, but it's still something that's worthy of investigation. So I proceeded to get together some information on where to go, where Spring Bay was located,
yes,
and who to talk to.
Yes.
And I had a chance to speak with the property owner, who mm-hmm. has since passed away, and he told me that I could go anytime I wanted to the property, which is 1/4 mile outside of Spring Bay.
Yes.
And sure enough, you get to the main road and you can't see it. So the one thing that was a tip-off right there that it couldn't have been a hoax was that the fact that you couldn't see it from the road. And the hoaxer, the first thing that they want to do is people see their work of art.
Oh, of course.
And of course, being in a clearing in the bush, I mean, surrounded by trees, you couldn't see it from the main road. So that was one thing.
Yeah.
The other thing I found was kind of strange was when we got to the circles themselves, we could sweep off the loose gravel off the limestone surface.
Uh-huh.
But as soon as you got to the edge or the center, there was also an accumulated mound of sand and gravel.
Yes.
They were both stuck together, like as if they were, like
a great heat and melted. Glue.
Yeah, something like that. Not quite melted, but because I know what melted glass would look like.
Yes,
if it was
but they adhered to each other, like they bonded.
Exactly, and I couldn't see anything at all. And I, to this day, I kind of kick myself for not having taken any samples. But I did go to the site repeatedly, and the last time I went there was September of '93, and you could have taken a broom and swept the whole area off, and whatever was holding sand and gravel together was no longer there.
It dissipated.
Yeah, the gravel, you could sweep off the gravel completely if you wanted to.
Really?
So it was a damn shame. But
did the person that you spoke to, who had reported it to this doll person you were talking about, the interviewer or what have you, did this person see lights at that night, or just discovered this thing, or it heard a noise? I don't think there's noise associated with it, though, if I recall. I think it's just lights, isn't it? How did it come about?
The only report of lights that I got was from a Mr. Misselbrook, who lived right next door, the only house in close proximity to the area.
Yeah.
And the story goes that he had a bad breathing problem, and he was up and around at around 4 o'clock in the morning, and he may have seen two lights side by side over the clearing, above the tree line at that time, but that's not verified.
Yeah.
So,
it's interesting sometimes when you get a sighting, and if people know who you are and they give you a call, and they're unbeknownst to each other, and if there is a trajectory involved, if you say you have someone seeing you at point A, seeing the unidentified flying object at point A, and then about 10 minutes later you get another call and there's someone at point B and seeing this, whatever it is, traveling in this trajectory, say it's southerly, and they call in unbeknownst to the other people. They don't know each other, but they're corroborating each other's story.
Yeah, and on top of that, it helps with the triangulation too, because
like
you, I'm not scientifically minded, but other people that are will be able to pretty well give a pretty good estimate of the size of the object based on the triangulation that they get from the two people from two different locations seeing the same object over a particular area.
Yeah. I know that a lot of the hoaxes years ago, we talked about swamp gas. Of course, mistaken identity. People wanted to see flying saucers, so they saw them. And temperature inversion and ionized air particles and all kinds of stuff. At least I think those were the words they used.
All the classics.
I don't know.
All the classics.
Yeah. And were there any others that, like, for example, now, are the crop circles associated with unidentified flying objects?
From what I get, I mean, I've been purchasing videotapes from the Ozark conference, UFO conference in Eureka Springs. Every April it takes place. And I ordered some tapes. And, of course, the leading authority in crop circles is Linda Moulton Howe and Nancy Talbot of the BLT team.
Yes.
They have websites here, which I brought the websites.
Okay.
They basically are saying that it's definitely unexplained. It's not people walking with boards and sticks and whatever. Because the soil is changed. See, the weird thing is, whatever energy is creating the crop circles is in excess of several hundred Fahrenheit and degrees in Fahrenheit.
Yes.
And if that was directly applied heat, it should have just scorched everything in sight.
Yes.
You know, and yet it doesn't. It just bakes the soil, but it changes the plant at a molecular level.
I was going to say it.
And it's like very precise and concise details and evidence that's only found in the circles themselves. They do take control samples also along outside of the crop circle pattern, and they have found that there's
a
great
difference.
Yeah, exactly. And the one case that they did study where it had all the criteria that they were looking for actually turns out to be a crop circle pattern in Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and the scientific paper that was written is just being viewed by peer review, and it will be posted on the net if it hasn't already.
I see. And when did this take place now, this one in Alberta?
I believe it was within the last 5 to 6 years. I'm not exactly sure.
Years,
I've got so many crop circle pictures on my computer. I've made sure that to identify the location, the date, and the year that they've actually showed up. So.
Yeah, and can other people see this at your website? Have you got a website?
I don't have a website yet. That's the one thing that everybody tells me I should have.
Yeah.
I'm still working on it.
You are? Okay. Well, I wish you all the best on it. No, I also remember, because we are mostly in northern climes, that I've heard about these snow circles, too.
Yeah, I did hear.
And I really think that's interesting.
Especially when one case in particular that I heard of was a couple that went ice fishing on a lake near Elliott Lake.
Oh, right around here.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. And what they found was, of course, there was snow. The lakes were iced up and it was snowed in, but maybe 4 feet of snow.
Yeah.
And they found two circles that were 20 feet across, completely straight down, sheer sides, right down to the surface of the ice.
Oh,
no explanation, no tracks going in or out.
I've never, ever, never heard of that.
It's as if a saucer, two of them, actually sat down straight from above and took off straight up.
Really?
So they're not leaving any sides like ovals. The straight sides are completely vertical.
They are.
So it's like they just sat down like a hot kettle kind of thing.
And you've got notes on this and everything else?
I actually have notes and pictures of another case that took place in Algonquin Park in the mid-90s.
Uh-huh.
And I actually have a written account that came with it. And the guy describes this one circle. It's actually a one circle that's you could tell it was whatever caused the circle actually what heated the ice, because the ice melted and refroze. There's a clean layer of ice on top of the old layer, and it's no more than 5-6 feet away from the shoreline, which is kind of odd. And there's an old snowmobile trail right next to it. It's in April of 97, I think it took place.
Oh, really? Not that long ago.
Yeah, and it's really neat to look at. I mean, they've actually clumped together in the same bag crop circles and ice circles, but I think that ice circles and ice rings, they look like they're actually gouged out.
Yes.
I think those are due to actually an object hovering really low to the ice surface.
Yeah.
Not at all belonging to the same family of crop circles.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's scientists and the researchers have to make a distinction between those two, I think.
Do you think they're both made by the same type of vehicle or the same type of machine or the same type of whatever it is?
The crop circles, a lot of reports and videotape of these little golf ball sized lights.
Yes.
Maneuvering in and out of the
pad. Yeah, I've seen those. Yeah.
There's one person in Holland who was actually able to predict where a circle is going to appear, and he's being investigated as we speak by Nancy Talbot. And there's one photo that just showed up where he seems to have photographed an alien being sitting on the couch or being in front of a couch, and he looks to be like almost like out of flux, out of phase. And apparently the beings that are in communication with him say that in no indirect form, they actually are the ones creating the circles. Now, whether or not they're communications of some kind or messages of some kind, nobody exactly knows for sure. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. that's the modern-day explanation or speculation about what these things are, the crop circles, some kind of message trying to tell us mm-hmm. that we're in trouble. You know, maybe the Earth is in trouble. Who knows?
Yeah. I have seen some pictures of the crop circles, and there's no way that some of them are so immense, and they're very beautiful. Mm. But I do know that there were changes in the plants within the perimeters of each circle or within each design.
Yeah.
There were molecular changes or changes at the molecular level in the blades of grass or the whatever crop was there. And I found that very interesting as well.
Sometimes it's in corn, and corn is pretty thick. The stalks
yes.
are at least one inch across,
yeah.
which would be pretty hard for somebody with a board to go in there
yes.
and do a swath.
Yes.
And some of these circles, like you said, are immense.
Yeah.
And also, in a lot of them, they actually find that the layering of the plant is actually either interwoven
yes.
or laid down in three separate patterns.
Oh,
the,
really?
The bottom pattern is actually in a spiral.
Yes.
Then the second layer on top of that either goes in one direction or the other.
Uh-huh.
And then the top layer actually is just like mangled plants. Kinked at some of the nodes or whatever, and the nodes
yeah.
are elongated, and there's also some of the nodes actually are blown out as if it's because they tested it in microwave ovens,
yeah.
and they noticed that the nodes are actually blown from the inside out. So
well, isn't that something? I find it also very fascinating. Now, I guess you're very well versed in, or are quite knowledgeable, or know of at least the work of that you know that doctor that works at Stanford or one of the universities. Who got involved with people who have been taken or claim they've been taken and spent time?
Oh, Harvard, Dr. Mack.
Dr. Mack at Harvard. That's
yeah.
right. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. He was quite interesting as well. I read some of his reports.
Yeah, I've investigated a few abduction cases myself.
Yes.
The only problem I have with a lot of the other researchers is when they're trying to educate people, which is the key. That's the key
yes,
of the whole
yes.
thing, is to use the information you've gathered and educate people.
And share it with others.
A lot of times they will use the abductions. They will skip ahead past the physical evidence, the landing cases, the UFO sightings, and they'll go to the abduction cases as a way to explain to people this is what's happening and this is the evidence.
Yeah.
But the thing is, in the abduction cases, there's very little evidence.
Yes.
The beings take the people through the windows or through the ceiling, and there's like no residue left
yes.
behind. Unlike a landing case where you may find traces of radiation, you
yeah.
may find traces of changed soil
yes.
and plants, and also sometimes animals have died due to radiation exposure, like a dog in a particular case in Indiana.
Oh, really?
So, as a matter of fact, I just ordered a book, which I just got, and one of the famous cases in the States is the Delphos, Kansas case of November 2nd, 1971.
Okay.
And this case was investigated by Ted Phillips
yes.
and also Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
I remember J. Allen Hynek. He headed up Project Blue Book for a while.
Yeah.
And then he resigned from that, saying that he could no longer say that, and that was USAF's, United States Air Force's investigative arm on UFO landings and sightings at the time. I'm quite knowledgeable on that part because it goes back far enough. It shows what my age is
yeah.
at, eh? Anyway, I remember that J. Allen Hynek had been a consultant to and headed up Project Blue Book. I think we called it the Condon Report, too. There was something involved there for USAF
yeah.
a long time ago, of course. And then they came out with an official thing saying it was mostly in everyone's head
mm-hmm.
and that it was all mistaken identity, what have you, and all the other good things we talked about a little earlier. But Hynek then changed his mind and said with so many, I can't remember the numbers, but with so many, couple hundred thousand, there were at least, that left at least, out of that, you could explain away, he said, maybe 150 to 170,000, but there were 30,000 that there were no explanations for, and that's what changed his mind to at least explore it further.
Yeah.
And of course, he's no longer with us,
no.
but he's quite an authority.
Yeah, and the one case that did change his mind was another landing case, but this time in New Mexico, in Socorro.
Yes,
1964,
I remember that
with
one
the police
well.
Officer Lonnie Zamora.
Yes,
that one case, the Cassius convinced him there was something to it.
Yes,
and he actually urged Ted Phillips. Ted Phillips, back then, was really young. He urged Ted Phillips to focus his attention only on the Lanny cases. And as of today, I believe that he's actually spoken to over 500 witnesses, and he's cataloged over 2,000 landing reports from 79 countries.
He has, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we hear about it all over the place now.
Mm.
But I remember this Lonnie Zamora. He was the equivalent of what we call an OPP, like in Canada, like or in Ontario. And he was a trained observer, of course, and quite very objective. Not a subjective given to, I mean, if I told you I saw a flying saucer, like I said, don't believe me. But when you get someone who's not emotional and trained to be objective and they say they've seen something, and it's corroborated by all the witnesses that corroborated in Socorro, Mexico, New Mexico, I agree.
Just like pilots, too. I mean,
yes.
I just did interviews with one former Bush pilot who's now a Justice of the Peace. And another one who is now a minister up in Englehart.
Oh, yes.
And being a pilot, too, they're not going to send kooks up there to fly planes.
No. At least they hope they don't.
Yeah. But, yeah, they've separately seen amazing things.
Yes.
And, you know, it adds to their credibility.
Do you still find, too, in your researches and everything, that a lot of people, well, I guess I'm just asking my own question. I just answered it posing this question to you is that a lot of people are afraid to come forward because of ridicule, and they simply don't want others to know what their thinking is or what their ideas are or what they've seen.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem that I have. Like I said, the couple who had that sighting in town,
yes,
because they've been in the media before, they would easily recognize.
Yes.
And the funny thing is, when I did try their email address and I tried to leave a message on their machine, they never got back to me. So I've lost people like that before, and it's frustrating that the government spent so many years building this big block, this wall of ridicule around the whole
wall
subject.
Wall of silence, yes.
That people are just redundant, they just don't want to, they're reluctant to come out and even talk to me.
Yeah.
And it's just frustrating.
Yeah. Well, I wish you, have you got anything else now? There are names you can share with people, and what about your phone number and where people can reach you, Michelle?
Well, my phone number is 670-2759.
670-2759. Okay.
And my email address is UFOman, lowercase, UFOman@ICANN.net, ICAN.NET.
All right, UFOman, is this all lowercase, one word?
Yes.
At?
ICANN.net.
.net,
yeah.
Okay.
And specify UFOs because I do have a filtering system and it'll bounce it back and I won't get the email if you don't specify a UFO sighting, whatever. I'll collect whatever sightings, whatever took place last year or 10 years ago. I'll take whatever.
Yes.
And then...
it's thanks to people like yourself that have such a magnificent obsession that we're still gathering a lot of snippets and information.
I'm the only one in the area. I have to do something. If I stop doing this, nobody else will.
Yeah. Well, if you have something else you want to share with us there, Michelle.
I sent in a couple of articles to the both local papers. After the sighting in May, there was also a sighting on May the 3rd in Moonbeam, and I was interviewed by French CBC Television.
Yes.
And the segment aired on July the 5th. And I proceeded to write something about, like, a little bit of an international note. There was this famous videotape that surfaced from the Mexican Air Force.
Yes.
Having had filmed 11 objects with an infrared camera while they were looking for drug smuggling planes. In March.
This wasn't the one, the ones I'm thinking about were the massive sightings that were over in Mexico City
in 91.
A few years ago.
No. This is totally new, and the lights were actually not being, they couldn't be seen with the naked eye, but the infrared camera picked them up. And the radar, the onboard radar, actually detected other objects following the plane from behind and other objects in the front. So in total, it brought up the number to 16 objects.
Well, that's interesting.
And this is very, very unprecedented that
the
officials will release videotapes to the researchers instead of releasing to the government, which of course will hide it forever. So I wrote something about that, and I also wrote something about last year's power blackout in reference to UFO sightings that took place in and around the time that it took place, as well as the 1965 blackout, which is more famous with that.
Yes.
Yeah. So pretty well the same general areas were affected, and still nobody has an adequate explanation to explain how how 300 megawatts of electricity could go back on itself, then doubling pretty well as 500 megawatts of electricity going back the other way.
Yes.
Some kind of, the only thing I can see, I'm not being, again, not scientifically minded, but we know that electromagnetic effects are connected to UFOs, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. a really strong electromagnetic field could be strong enough to repulse the electricity and make it go back up the line. Mm-hmm. I mean, my friend accuses the project ARP, H-A-A-R-P.
Yes, I know all about ARP.
But I
yes.
am very doubtful that that thing, which is set up way in the Alaska,
yes.
can be as precise to actually hit the power grid somewhere down here and knock everything out.
Yeah, that's another story
that's
in
another
itself,
story,
ARP,
yeah.
and it's quite a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
But,
so I basically wrote these and I dropped them off at the papers and we'll see what they do.
Okay.
I just that people have to know that there's a good likelihood that the power blackout of last year was actually connected to UFO sightings in Ohio and other places.
Yeah.
As for sure, we know the 1965 power blackout mm-hmm. was connected mm-hmm. to UFOs. The Air Force knew it. The UFOs were in the area 45 minutes before the lights went out.
Yeah.
And some guy who actually investigated that also was on site at a famous crash. A UFO crash case in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania in 65 also.
Okay.
So.
Well, if you'll come back in the fall, we'll continue with this.
For sure.
Okay. Thanks for coming in, Michelle.
You're
and
welcome.
It's always great talking to you. I haven't seen you in a while. I'll get some music on and then I can say goodbye.
Goodbye.
So hold on, everybody. We're going to continue on with a beginner's guide to jazz because we know what happened last time, so we're okay now. And I thank you for coming in, Michelle.
You're welcome.